has to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
My thanks to the fine folks who subscribe to this program, like Susan Fellows, David Pennell, Deborah Newell, and Stuart Smith. We've got a bonus book for you, a copy of Hank Albarelli's A Terrible Mistake for new subscribers this month. So tell your friends and people who you think should be listening to this podcast to check in and find out about the bonus offer at peterbcollins.com. In the second portion of today's podcast, we'll meet Rebecca from Peace Action West and learn about a PAC for Peace. This has been the year of the super PACs, where about two dozen super wealthy people, mostly Republicans, have been funding these alternative campaign efforts called political action committees and super PACs, unleashed by the Citizens United decision from the Supreme Court a couple of years ago. And how about it, a PAC for Peace? Take that, Sheldon Adelson. But first, Gareth Porter returns to our program, journalist and historian. He has been focusing a lot on the conflicts and potential conflicts from the Middle East to Afghanistan, and he writes on a regular basis, and I really value his voice. Gareth, welcome back.
Thanks very much, Peter. Good to be back again.
Well, I wanted to start off with an update on the tensions with Iran following the recent six-party plus Iran summit meeting in Istanbul, Turkey, and the agreement to meet again later in May. How do you characterize, and feel free to separate yourself from the corporate media views that we hear in this country, but how do you characterize the state of play and whether these discussions in Istanbul were in fact valuable?
Well, I think it's certainly a good thing that the United States and the other members of this permanent five plus one, the three Europeans plus China and Russia, as well as the U.S., sat down with Iran, and that nobody is publicly, sort of posturing in a very aggressive way, at least at this stage of the game. I mean, that's a positive, no question about that. But behind that, of course, lies some very big questions about just how serious the United States is at this historical juncture about negotiating on an equal, basis of mutual respect for each other's basic interests with Iran. I mean, this is a situation where we have decades of history of U.S. hostility, which is, takes official forms, both in terms of economic sanctions, which go back to the 1990s and have continued to have one set of sanctions piled on top of another. And, of course, on top of that, you have the designation of Iran as a terrorist state, a state sponsor of terrorism, which is a very serious accusation, and one that has also been used by the United States for decades now to hold Iran as an enemy state. And, this is the concern that I have is primarily whether the Obama administration has made any real progress in digging itself out of that hole to the extent necessary to really put on the table an offer that can lead to a real agreement with Iran. And that's a subject that we can, I think, spend more time talking about, but that's the short version of it. They are on the other side of the table. I think the Iranians, my argument is that the Iranians have been willing to negotiate a broad agreement that does not just cover the nuclear issue, that is to say, assuring, taking steps that would assure the United States and other countries of the Iranian lack of interest in and indeed willingness to forego nuclear weapons, but also that would cover these more fundamental questions of the United States' official hostility toward Iran and the legitimate regional interests of Iran in the Middle East and the Persian Gulf, which is to say, essentially recognition that Iran as a major state in that region has a right to have influence, has a right to support those elements in other countries that are Shia, which are under attack, for example, in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
Those Shia in places like Bahrain, which are a majority, as in the case of Iraq, but are being ruled by a Sunni minority, which is using violence to try to suppress it. And indeed, you know, like any other significant regional power, you know, has a right to defend its interests. And I think that the Iranians have been essentially following a strategy, a diplomatic strategy, if you will, of accumulating all of the potential negotiating chips that they could accumulate. And those negotiating chips include such things as helping the United States out in Iraq when the United States was still stationing troops there, helping them to stabilize the situation, helping the United States in Afghanistan when it appeared the United States had some interest in stabilizing the situation, and other regional issues where the Iranians were offering to cooperate with the U.S. against, for example, al-Qaeda and its allies. But the most important negotiating chips of all for the Iranians have been the accumulation of low-enriched uranium, which, of course, the Iranians are quite well aware. The United States and other countries are acutely sensitive to and want to do something to prevent those stocks of low-enriched uranium being converted into a nuclear weapon. And therefore, the Iranians recognize that they have something valuable that the United States wants to deal with at the negotiating table. And that has been really quite clearly the primary hope that the Iranians have had, that they could get the United States to sit down and actually deal with the broad range of issues in something which has been characterized as the grand bargain.
Now, on this side of the Atlantic, Gareth, we hear all the tough talk and sanctions against certain aspects of the government called a regime in Tehran and efforts to get third-party nations to stop buying oil from Iran, to cut off their foreign exchange. Do you think Iran has any sense of the cost of all this to the United States and the Western world? Because we know that there is a glut of crude oil in the United States. I just did a story the other day that a tanker returned to Valdez, Alaska, with a third of its load because there wasn't room in the holding tanks in near Seattle to offload it. And so we know there's enough crude oil, but we're paying record high prices at the gas pump. And some of that is clearly due to speculation. Some 60% of world oil stocks are now at play in it under speculators' influence. But it really seems that the crisis premium linked to the tensions with Iran is one of the tangible factors that is driving the high cost of gasoline at the pump in the United States. And, of course, we don't really admit that that is the cost of the saber-rattling that we do on behalf of Israel.
Absolutely. I mean, you couldn't be more correct, Peter, in making that analysis, that there is indeed a high cost at the gasoline pump for the United States and Israel to rattle the saber. And in this case, of course, the saber in question is the threat of an Israeli attack on Iran in order to supposedly intimidate and to coerce diplomatically the Iranians at the negotiating table. And, of course, this has been going on now for literally years, but it has actually been stepped up quite dramatically since last fall. And as a result of that new level of tension, which was created by quite deliberate strategy by Israel and the Obama administration working together, I would argue, there has clearly been an increase in the price of oil. And this is driven both by, I would say primarily, by the possibility of a confrontation, you know, which is precisely what Obama and Netanyahu have been trying to create a sense of for diplomatic purposes, but that has a clear-cut financial economic cost for the United States and indeed for the entire world economy, because it does mean an increase in crude oil prices of 25% or higher. And according to the latest study that I've seen cited by a think tank in London, an economic think tank, the Iranians stand to basically earn as much as $58 billion, as I recall, maybe it was $56 billion, in 2012, which would make it the third highest amount of profit from crude oil exports in the history of Iran's oil exports. And this, of course, is due to precisely this premium that has been added to the price because primarily of the increased tensions and the possibility of a military confrontation, which it would imply some serious degree of risk of a basically cutoff of world oil supplies, which pass, for the most part, through the Strait of Hormuz, which the Iranians are able to close at least for a matter of weeks, if not longer.
And Gareth, what is, if you could thumbnail for us, the current state of inspections by the UN Atomic Agency in Iran, in particular the Fordo site near Qom, the holy city north of Tehran, because that has been the subject of some back and forth. And the last I recall, the Iranians had relented and allowed the inspectors in. Do you believe the inspectors have seen everything, or is there still a bit of a hide-and-seek game?
No, there's no hide-and-seek at Qom. The inspectors have access to the entire site. They know precisely, they have the design of the site, which has been turned over by the Iranians. They've gone to check the design physically. They have given their stamp of approval to the design papers that were given to the IAEA by Iran. And so they know perfectly well what is at the site. And they have continued to visit and to inspect it and to verify that the Iranians are telling the truth about what is there. And indeed, the truth is that the Iranians have not really begun to install centrifuges. There's no centrifuges actually operating at Qom. And this is indeed part of the reason that the United States and Israel have agreed, along with the European partners of those two countries, to demand of Iran in this first round, at least, of the talks, and as far as I know, this still has not been withdrawn because I don't think they've gotten to that level of detail yet, the closure of the Qom enrichment facility and ultimately its dismantlement, its physical dismantlement, which I presume would mean that they're actually demanding that the Iranians blow up the cavern which was created so that nothing could be done there. That is, at least in theory, what is on the table as far as the United States is concerned. This has been leaked to the media before the talks began in Istanbul a couple of weeks ago, more than a couple of weeks ago now. And this, of course, is absolutely a non-starter. There's no possibility that the Iranians are going to agree to the closure of that site, because it was chosen, it was opened up precisely to make the targeting of an Israeli strike against Iran more difficult, and indeed to deter such a strike by making that problem of targeting complex for the Israelis. And I've written about this 3 years ago when the situation was first in the headlines. And indeed, I think there was evidence at that point that the Iranians had been successful because some senior Israeli military officials had publicly suggested that although they would like to see the United States attack the facilities, the nuclear facilities in Iran, that they were not in favor of Israeli forces trying to do so because, for one thing, that there was just too much uncertainty created by the site at Qom, which was able to protect centrifuges and other equipment needed for the enrichment from an Israeli strike. So it's precisely for the deterrence of a strike that enrichment facility exists, and for the Iranians to give that up in negotiations would make absolutely no sense from a rational point of view.
And Gareth, if we can lapse into rational thinking here for just a moment, the objective data that is available show that the national intelligence estimates, most recently, some that were buried behind the coverage of the threats from Bibi Netanyahu on his most recent swirl through Washington. But our intelligence communities are very clear that they do not believe that Iran has the intention or the current capability to develop a nuclear weapon. In addition to that, the generals have quietly leaked their own views that a military assault on Iran would be ridiculous, suicidal in some respects, because, number one, the swagger and assurance that we kind of get from the Israeli position that they could simply swoop in and take out these facilities with no cost to the attacking parties is false. It's simply a canard. And when we look at the various ways that Iran could strike back directly or through proxies, the cost of such an assault is something that is staggering and, in fact, was giving great pause to our military leaders, given our overextension in other parts of the world.
Yeah.
So now that we're speaking rationally about this, what real basis is there for the hysteria that an assault on Iran must happen and must happen soon because, you know, they simply cannot be permitted to develop a nuclear weapon?
Well, there's no basis rationally whatsoever. And indeed, I'm prepared now to go beyond what I would have said the last time we spoke, Peter, with regard to the threat of an Israeli attack on Iran. And I think you've correctly stated the position of the U.S. military about not just an Israeli attack, but a U.S. attack would be irrational. It would be too costly for the United States. And I think that's really out of the question entirely. I mean, it has been, I think, quite clear for some time that that's not on the table, despite the talk about this by the White House. But with regard to an Israeli attack, I'm now prepared to say, Peter, that I believe I am 95 to 99% certain that Bibi Netanyahu's threats and Ehud Barak's threats of an attack as a possibility or a probability against Iran in 2012 or in those in the general period of 2012-2013 is a bluff. It is a poker game that they have been playing with cards that I think that they're hiding very successfully from the world, but which are very weak cards indeed. And this was the result. I mean, this conclusion that I'm now giving you is the result of my trip to Israel for 9 days in March, in mid to late March, during which I had a chance to meet with some relatively senior former national security officials in Israel, including the father of the Israeli anti-missile defense system, if you will, the official who, as a brigadier general in the Israeli defense forces, actually founded the Israeli anti-missile defense program in 1991 and was the head of it until 1999. So he headed it for an entire decade. And he is undoubtedly as well informed about the Iranian ballistic missile program and its ability to retaliate against an Israeli attack and to overcome the Israeli missile defense system as anyone in that country. And he told me that the Iranians have increased the accuracy of their missiles to the point where they could, in fact, very well attack the administrative targets, the key administrative targets of Israel, which are clustered in a few major cities, and also hit key infrastructure targets in a few major cities and basically create chaos in that society. And that, I mean, he acknowledged that although the missile defense system has shown the ability to shoot down 80% of the Iranian missiles in various tests, and of course those are not really Iranian missiles at all, but yeah, theoretical targets, that in fact, you know, the actual success against Iranian missiles in an actual conflict would undoubtedly be less than that, probably quite a bit less than that.
That's their Iron Dome is the equivalent or their response to America's Star Wars missile defense system.
Well, the Iron Dome is actually the missile defense system for use against the short range missiles from Gaza or from southern Israel, southern Lebanon, excuse me. But the system that they have for the ballistic missiles from Iran is entirely different. Is an entirely different one, and cannot boast the same degree of success that they have claimed for the Iron Dome, which was, you know, they claimed that they had shot down virtually everything with no casualties in Israel, and so, you know, the contrast between the two I think is quite dramatic and worth keeping in mind here.
Mm-hmm. And I'll also just note the double standard or hypocrisy that the world was ratcheting up the rhetoric when North Korea launched a bottle rocket that fizzled, but when India launched a missile that succeeded in reaching its target, I don't remember whether it was an Earth target or orbit, nobody really said too much. And that kind of dual response has to have an impact in Tehran, where they're acutely aware that the driver of the anti-nuclear policy toward Iran is the nuclear power of Israel.
Yes, of course, there's a double, triple standard here at work, which is based on, I mean, I'm talking now about the United States, its European allies, and the International Atomic Energy Agency, which does the bidding of those countries, have consistently hewed to a very wide difference in standards applied to the United States, Israel, the allies of the United States on one hand, and the Iranians on the other. So that's definitely well documented. I've written about that myself. Yeah. But let me just come back to make a key point that I don't want to make don't want to miss in this conversation, and that is that what Uzi Rubin, this retired brigadier general and father of the anti-missile program in Israel, and another senior retired national security official, Yossi Alfer, who was a Mossad analyst, senior Mossad intelligence analyst, and now you know, is involved in Israeli-Palestinian peace dialogue, both told me that the senior national security officials, retired national security officials in Israel, who believe that an attack on Iran is entirely irrational and know perfectly well that it cannot be done, simply is not a rational option, have been keeping quiet, have not been speaking out, with Meir Dagan being the former Mossad chief being an exception to that. And the reason that they have not been speaking out is they simply do not believe that Bibi Netanyahu is serious. They believe that he's bluffing, and therefore they are not planning to speak out, primarily because they feel the bluff has been successful, and therefore they don't want to disrupt this successful strategy on the part of the Israeli government. So what's what I believe, Peter, has been going on for the last several months, since last fall, is something that I wish I had written about before, but I was not sufficiently acute in my analysis to have caught, and that is that the Obama administration and the Netanyahu government have been carrying out a very clear-cut good cop, bad cop routine in which the Obama administration constantly cites the danger of an Israeli attack and acts as though they're trying to restrain it, but they simply don't know if they can do so.
Right.
And at the same time, you know, tell the Iranians that, you know, now is the time to negotiate. And I think that has been the game that has been played now since last fall.
Two more items, and then I want to talk about Afghanistan. One is the recent report that the last Bush Attorney General, Michael Mukasey, is now lobbying in Washington to take away the claim of terrorist status from the murky group called Mujahideen-e-Khalq, M-E-K. Yes. And many foreign observers see the M-E-K as a proxy force being used to destabilize the government in Iran. But it has quite a sordid history, and you know, the terrorist label appears to be accurate. And, of course, the Attorney General is able to advocate for these people without being hauled up on charges of material support for a terrorist group, which is what happened to a pharmacist from Pittsburgh who advocated for jihad but never actually picked up a weapon.
It's a major scandal, Peter, which ought to be on the front pages of every newspaper in the country. And you know, there should be outraged howls of outrage from Congress, calling for these people to be, basically given the same treatment as others who mm-hmm. have been prosecuted on the basis of this very, I would say, dangerous law that basically has a very loose and very broad definition of assisting foreign terrorist entities. I mean, I think the law should be changed, but the law is on the books,
yeah.
And this, in fact, should be applied not just to Mukasey, but to a broad range of people who have been lobbying on behalf of the MEK now for some months and have been paid off by the MEK or by people who are supporters of the MEK
mm-hmm.
For their speeches and lobbying efforts.
Yeah, I think it is stunning. And you posted an article at antiwar.com on April 19th about some of the history of the so-called nuclear fatwa attributed to the Supreme Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. And this gets into principles of whether the Iranian government is committed not to develop a nuclear weapon, and if so, why that is so routinely overlooked by the United States, but now has recently been used as a bit of a bargaining chip.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm glad you flagged that article because, you know, from my point of view, one of the most serious, most egregious sins of the corporate media in the past few weeks has been the fact that both the New York Times and the Washington Post have written or published stories that have highlighted what they claim is a historical bit of information that they are alleging shows that Ali Khamenei, the supreme leader of Iran, is really not being honest when he cites this so-called fatwa that nuclear weapons are illegitimate under Islam. Now, just to sort of set the record straight here, we should be clear that the definition of a fatwa particularly Shia theology and theological law, it does not require some elaborate publication or document. It means that any time that a senior cleric who is qualified to make such legal judgment says that a particular practice is illegal or forbidden in Islam, then that is binding on his followers. And no serious analyst at this point argues that that Ayatollah Ali Khamenei is not qualified to issue such a fatwa. And indeed, he has not just once or twice, not a few times, but many times over the last nearly two decades stated quite clearly that nuclear weapons are inconsistent with Islam, and that therefore Iran will not procure, will not use, or will not obtain nuclear weapons. And so that is a very important piece of documentation, if you will, about Iran's intentions. And I'll give you another reason as to why this is not simply sort of an irrelevant piece of information. And that is that during the Iran-Iraq war, it's well documented, of course, that the Iraqi government of Saddam Hussein used chemical weapons quite aggressively against Iran over and over again, beginning in late 1983, 1984. As many as 7,000 Iranians were killed outright by chemical weapons, and as many as 100,000 seriously injured by chemical weapons during that war, from 1984 roughly to the end of the war in 1988. And yet, the Iranians, it is now clearly documented historically that the Iranians did not retaliate by using chemical weapons against Iraq. Now, the reason for that failure or refusal to retaliate with chemical weapons is very clearly that the senior clerics in Qom, the religious center of Iran, during the 1980s, during that war, were quite clear and quite vociferous in stating that they regarded chemical weapons as illegal, forbidden, under Islam. And the Khomeini government, Ali Ayatollah Khomeini, the head of the founder of Islamic Iran,
right.
Iranian regime, and then the supreme leader of Iran, publicly basically said that they would not have weapons of mass destruction, and we now, I think, know very clearly that that was indeed the real policy of Iran. Now, those people who are arguing, and this comes back to the New York Times and Washington Post, that there was a secret meeting in 1984 in which the present Supreme Leader stated, when he was president of the country, stated on behalf of the then Supreme Leader, that Iran was secretly resuming the nuclear program that had been called off by Khomeini because it was necessary to meet the threat from the United States and Israel. Those people are going to have to explain why the Iranians would say we're now going to try to go for a nuclear weapon, while at the same time they were refusing to do anything to retaliate with chemical weapons against the attacks by the Iraqis, when chemical weapons were much more at hand, much more easily obtained in order to retaliate, to do something about the immediate threat. And furthermore, I'll just add one more point, and then I'll shut up about this, that it is well documented that, in fact, the nuclear program of Iran was resumed after a brief hiatus after the Islamic Revolution of 1979, as early as 1981, not in 1984.
Very interesting. Gareth Porter with us here on the Peter B. Collins Show. There's much more, and I encourage you to read his articles. Antiwar.com is where I often look. Gareth, is there another destination that people can find all of your reports?
Well, there are two places that have good archives of my articles. One is ipsnews.net. ipsnews.net, and the second one is antiwar.com, which has basically kept all of my articles over the years.
Great. Now, let's turn to Afghanistan, where since the last time we spoke, we've had another exposure of grisly photographs of American troops celebrating their killing of adversaries by dangling body parts and taking these salacious photos. We've had a very severe staged attack by the Taliban that lasted for more than 18 hours before they could be repulsed from central Kabul. We have this rosy report from NATO that the Afghan troops are going to be ready to take over at the end of 2014, if not sooner. And yet the occupation, particularly during an election year for a president who wants to position himself as the guy who wants to bring the troops home, well, it's just one bad report after another. And more recently, we've seen some sort of initial negotiation completed on long-term aid to Afghanistan to the tune of almost $3 billion a year for at least 10 years, starting in 2014. So the cost to the United States in money and in human lives is increasing, and it really extends as far as the eye can see. And we even have seen polls that show that most Republicans now think that Afghanistan was a bad idea and that it's a real good idea to get out as soon as possible.
Yeah, this is a war that is literally dying before our eyes, in the sense that the political support for it, sort of the minimum level of political support, is collapsing more and more every day. This is what I had thought would happen 2 years ago, Peter. I was predicting that there would be a repeat of what had happened in 2006 in Iran, when the U.S. military was clearly unable to prevent basically a civil war between Sunni and Shia, which was claiming thousands of lives civilian lives per month. And the reaction was essentially among the political elite to essentially give up. They said this is not working. And I thought that the same thing was going to happen in 2010 under McChrystal, but it did not. They were able to delay it for a couple of years, but I think that is precisely what is happening right now. A friend of mine, Matt Ho, you may be familiar with
sure.
the name, he was a State Department official, senior civilian official in Zabul province, and quit in protest against U.S. policy in late 2008. He just spoke with me the other day, and he said that he has friends who are colonels and lieutenant colonels now back from Afghanistan and in the Pentagon who, a year and a half ago would have, they were kind of agnostic. They were saying they would still trust the senior officials that they know what they're doing, although they had their doubts. But within the last year, those people have clearly decided that this is not working. This war is simply a lost cause. I think that is one of the most telling points about where we are in this war. And then there's a second one that I would mention to you if you haven't already encountered it. There is a report issued by NATO about the Taliban, about the Taliban insurgency,
mm-hmm.
which, far from declaring that the Taliban are in a defeated position or are in retreat, makes the point that over the last year, the Taliban have never been more confident that they would be victorious. And I think that the key to this confidence that the NATO report cites is the degree to which the illegitimacy of the forces that are arrayed against them, both the foreign troops, primarily American troops, of course, but all foreign troops, but also the Afghan troops that are allied with the foreign troops, has never been as extremely clear as it has been this past year. And I think that has been a factor that has buoyed the hopes of the Taliban tremendously. And the number of people who have been killed, the number of insurgents who have been killed, whatever that number has been, is really totally irrelevant to the insurgency's hopes and morale, which have, as I've suggested, this NATO report is holding, that has never been higher.
And Gareth, a couple of other recent developments. Our puppet Karzai is now threatening to resign a year early so that he doesn't have to be on hand during the exodus of American and what's left of NATO troops. And he also appears to have won an agreement from the United States that night raids will no longer occur without approval of the Afghan government and participation by Afghan police or military forces. Will that agreement hold, and will Karzai make good on his threat to bail?
Well, first of all, let me talk about the agreement on night raids, which, as I reported some weeks ago, was the real crux of the problem of reaching agreement between the United States and the Karzai regime on a post-2014 U.S. military presence in the country, what they call the strategic partnership. And I think there's a lot of misunderstanding and perhaps lack of good reporting on this point, because you've correctly, I think, summarized the way in which this has been reported, that the United States has made a compromise, that it has agreed that the Afghans will be in the lead, that the United States will no longer sort of carry these out on its own behest, you know, regardless of the desires of the Afghan government. If you actually examine carefully what has been said in the briefing in Kabul by the U.S. military spokesman, John Kirby, he does not really say that at all. What he says is that the situation is really unchanged from what it was last December, in that the United States puts Afghan special forces up front, knocking on the door, as sort of the first phase of a night raid. But U.S. special forces are still going to be in on these night raids. The targeting has not changed. The targeting is still going to be controlled by U.S. special forces. They're going to decide who's going to be hit and when and where. And the question of whether the Karzai regime has a veto power is really crucial to this. And Kirby answered the question as to whether there would be a veto by saying no. The government will not have a veto over this. The fact is that if the special forces believe that it is necessary, that there's a time constraint here, that they cannot get the approval of this small group of Afghans who are supposedly going to be passing judgment on the validity of a request for a night raid, then they can go ahead and do it themselves. So basically, the reality is nothing's changed.
Wow.
And that this is simply another case of the U.S. military being able to do whatever it wants and passing this agreement off as somehow, meeting the real interests and the sovereignty of the country in which they're operating. The same thing happened, of course, in Iraq with the withdrawal agreement.
Well, you've just added remarkable, important, and somewhat contradictory detail to the narrative offered by the corporate media in this country. Now to the threat of Karzai to bail.
Yes. Well, I mean, it's hard for me to know exactly what his calculus is at this point, but I would not be at all surprised if he doesn't see the writing on the wall here. By the way, he does not have, there is no agreement to provide any specific level of even economic assistance to the Karzai regime in the future beyond 2014. That's one of the things that Karzai wanted, and he has not gotten it.
Hmm.
And there's also no agreement yet on how many U.S. troops will stay there. So, I mean, it's kind of interesting here that they're claiming that there is agreement, but the fact is that the only thing that's been agreed to is that the Karzai regime has basically caved in. In reality, on the issue of the night raids.
That's interesting because the New York Times has cited a figure, I think, of $2.9 billion a year.
There may be talk about that. There may be a sort of a vocal agreement on it, but there's nothing in writing at this point. There's no commitment, formal commitment to that.
Yeah. Well, Gareth, there's much more I'd love to talk about, but time has run here, and I will be in touch. We'll get an update from you down the road.
Good to talk to you again, Peter.
Gareth Porter here on the Peter B. Collins Show. 2012 may go down as the year of the PAC, the Super PAC. As Citizens United, the Supreme Court decision unleashed millions of dollars, mostly from corporate and super wealthy interests. How about a peace PAC?
As I walk through this wicked world. Of insanity, I ask myself, is all hope lost? Is there only pain, hatred, and misery? And each time I feel like this inside, there's one thing I want to know. What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding?
That's my man, Cab Mo. Covering the Elvis Costello tune, What's So Funny About Peace, Love, and Understanding? Rebecca Griffin joins us now. She is political director at Peace Action West, located here in the Bay Area in Oakland. And we're going to talk about their efforts, including their involvement in the political cycle this year. Rebecca, welcome to the PBC show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tell us a little bit about Peace Action West and what work you've done to date.
Well, we are a grassroots organization that works to build a bridge between communities and policymakers in D.C. around challenges, global challenges that we face, and promoting peaceful solutions to those, and having a way for people to get active around around really pushing for the foreign policy that they want to see happen. And mm-hmm. so we've been around since the late 1950s working to eliminate the threat of nuclear weapons, to resolve conflicts through diplomacy, to stop the illegal arms trade and human rights abuse in the arms trade. So we have a long history of this kind of work, and we're really looking at pumping up our work in elections and being more of a player in that realm as well.
And do you have a plan to shut down as soon as peace breaks out across the globe?
I hope that day will come someday where we can all go home and I'm out of a job, but unfortunately I don't think that'll be too soon.
Yeah. Now, tell us a little bit about the voter fund that Peace Action West has organized this year. And give me a quick explanation. Is Peace Action West a 501c3 or a c4?
Mm-hmm. Well, Peace Action West is a 501c4. We also mm-hmm. have a 501c3, the Peace Education Fund.
Okay.
So we do most of our advocacy work through the 501c4, but we also have what's called a Connected PAC, a Political Action Committee, which is the Peace Action West Voter Fund. And what we're doing with that this year is that we really want to organize a way for people who care about peace to have a voice in this election, to really make the peace movement a force in electoral politics in a way that it hasn't been before. And this year offers a lot of opportunities for that, with redistricting happening, with the fact that the public is very tired of being at war after more than a decade. So I think we have some real opportunities to make an impact this year.
And give me your sense of the landscape here, because I fully support your mission and the political activism portion of it. The problem I see is that since Obama was elected, the left has largely gone silent, the Democratic left, the elected left. And while the polls show overwhelmingly, for example, that Americans oppose the continued presence in Afghanistan, they think that the president's dual escalations, two rounds of so-called surges of American forces into Afghanistan, we're now at about the 100,000 level, and for election purposes, it's going to decline a little bit this year. But we know that the so-called combat troops will remain at least until the end of 2013, if the tip from Leon Panetta is to be believed, and probably beyond 2014, if we accept reality of these kinds of engagements. So where do you find Democrats who are willing to stand up to their own president, because he has prevailed remarkably on his Pentagon issues, if you will, since he became president?
Well, it's actually, you know, quite remarkable just the amount of change that we've seen in Congress since President Obama was inaugurated in 2009. The opposition to the war in Afghanistan has skyrocketed. And, you know, the high water mark last year, we very nearly passed an amendment calling for a plan to accelerate withdrawal from Afghanistan. An amendment like that did pass in a voice vote in the Senate. You know, you had all but eight Democrats voting for that. And, you know, that's the product of, you know, really intensive grassroots organizing, working to push these people and show that people want to see change. And I've been impressed in talking to people, you know, even after the president has, you know, made noises to convince people that he's ending the war, that a lot of the members of Congress aren't satisfied with that and do want to speak up. And I think that's a testament to the fact that, you know, not only is the public opinion there, but that, you know, we and other groups have been able to really mobilize people to show that not only are people fed up with the war, but they want Congress to do something about it. And, you know, in the next few weeks, I think we're going to see a lot more action there. And I've also seen a tremendous difference just in the candidates that I'm talking to. You know, back in 2010, I think there were a lot fewer candidates who were willing to say they wanted to get out of Afghanistan, to say they didn't support the president's plans. And I'm not having that kind of problem in 2012. And the candidates I'm talking to are on board with getting out of Afghanistan. You know, a lot of them are willing to press the president to go faster than he wants to go. So I think we're seeing a big upswing.
But Rebecca, to be clear, these are challengers, not incumbents, right?
They're both. We have both challengers and incumbents on our list of endorsed candidates. Mm-hmm. And as I said, you know, we work with a lot of current members of Congress who are pushing for a faster withdrawal from Afghanistan, and people that you wouldn't necessarily expect either. You know, it's not just the Congressional Progressive Caucus who's been with us and been really wonderful leaders on this issue, you know, but it's people like Senator Max Baucus from Montana, you know, very moderate Democrat, not someone anyone would have expected to be at the forefront of this effort, but has been very clear in pushing the president to say that the current plans are not good enough.
Mm-hmm. Well, I understand your point. My concern is that the way things have, the dynamics in the last couple of years have been that there may be Democrats working quietly behind the scenes, but they are unwilling to challenge the president. And it's really frustrating for me that people, and let me just name a couple of names, Barbara Lee from Oakland, Sam Farr from Monterey. These are people who were outspoken in fighting George W. Bush for a timeline and withdrawal from Iraq. And yet, while they still hold those positions relative to Afghanistan, they don't give full voice to it. And they don't use the same tactics to confront a president of their own party, as they did with Bush.
Well, I think you might not see it splashed all over the newspapers, but that kind of activity is still happening. I mean, Representative Lee has, as you know, she was the only person who voted against the war authorization in 2001, but she's been very active. She has legislation to prohibit funding for anything beyond withdrawal of troops. She's offered that consistently. She's offered amendments along those lines. She's published op-ed. She's given floor speeches. So she is very active. People might not be paying as much attention to it because of the, you know, because of the other stories or because of how much the media chooses to cover Afghanistan. But she has been steadfast in her opposition and very, very vocal. And again, she's not the only one. We've seen a lot of efforts with, you know, open public letters to the president with votes on amendments that have happened, and again, coming from people all across the board. So I think that, you know, it's important for people to recognize that significant progress has been made, and, you know, and that's one of the reasons why getting involved in the elections right now is so important, is that people, if you look at, you know, what some in the media will say, like, oh, people don't care about the war in Afghanistan, they're not going to vote on that. But we know that's not true, and we're proving it by activating peace voters in elections and in a very visible way so that candidates know where their support is coming from and what the expectations are that peace voters have of them when they get into office.
And Rebecca, just one more on this issue of challenging President Obama. MoveOn.org, which was very vocal, and I remember the flap over General Petraeus, don't betray us, they were very sharply challenging President Bush. But this year, they're focused on an effort called the 99 Spring, which I see as, unfortunately, a way of watering down the impact of the Occupy movement and trying to move some of the suburban sympathizers of Occupy into voting for Democrats. And while I do believe that domestic issues are very important and that the Occupy movement has identified very critical matters that people should be weighing in this election cycle, they've been pretty quiet on the war and peace issues over there at Move On.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, there may be some groups that are not as focused on this right now, but, you know, as a nonpartisan organization, you know, we're always focused on the mission. And you know, if a president is doing something we don't like, whether it's a Democrat or Republican, we're going to be clear about that and push members of Congress to do that as well. You know, and again, that's why it's really important for people to be getting active right now in these elections, because, you know, one of the problems is if you just are giving money to the Democratic Party or the DCCC or whatever it is, you know, that could go to any candidate who has any sort of position on peace issues. Whereas with the work that we're doing, we're thoroughly vetting candidates and we're only throwing our support behind people who agree with our priorities and are willing to be active on them once they get into office.
Now, Rebecca, in the segment preceding this conversation in my podcast today, we talked with Gareth Porter about the situation related to Iran and also the continuing mess in Afghanistan. And I note that in May of 2009, you traveled to Iran. And I wanted to get your thoughts on the way that President Obama has managed to keep Israel from attacking Iran in the near term. And I consider that an important coup for the president, given the political dynamics of the Israeli lobby and doing this in an election year. At the same time, We're continuing to ratchet up sanctions that are costing us in increased gasoline prices at the pump. That's really the only explanation for the huge increase in fuel prices here in this country. And I think that it's all a misguided effort. Certainly, nobody wants to see an additional country develop nuclear weapons. But the idea that we would start a conflict to prevent the development of a nuclear weapon in Iran, given their capabilities to respond and retaliate, I find it to be sheer madness.
Absolutely. And I think, I agree that the president is walking a very fine line, a very difficult line in balancing the various interests here. And I think it is important that he's managed to, stave off any kind of attack so far, and that he is pushing back against, what he called the loose talk of war. So I think that's important. I think part of the problem is that, our government has neglected non-military solutions in so many different conflicts that they don't even recognize what positive diplomacy looks like. And so in the absence of going for a full-on military conflict, people just go to sanctions as an effort to say we're doing something, we're ratcheting up the pressure without really gaming out whether that's going to get us the results that we want. And so we're certainly concerned about the fact that, Congress in particular has been very counterproductive in pushing for more sanctions, and that, the diplomatic efforts are important, and hopefully the next round of talks at the end of May will move things forward. But we want to see, really a much more comprehensive approach to diplomacy. When I traveled to Iran, I had the opportunity to really talk with people there about how they viewed our government's policies and the U.S. attitude toward Iran. And they were incredibly welcoming to us as individual Americans, but obviously had a lot of issues with the way our government was handling things. And I think that kind of perspective of what this looks like on the Iranian side is missing from a lot of the approach. So I think that they really need to go in, as John Limbert, who was a diplomat in the hostage crisis in Iran and a really great thinker on this issue, said, they need to use the yellow pad approach that Nixon used and write down what do we want, what do they want, and really think it through and look at negotiations as something that should be mutually beneficial, that we get something out of it, but also so does the Iranian government. So I think it's good that the administration is resistant to war, but we are afraid that the escalating rhetoric and sanctions could back them into a corner. So we feel like it's a really important time to push back on that.
And what is your organization's view of the inconsistency of U.S. policy related to the so-called Arab Spring? Because, in particular in Bahrain, we are still supporting a royal dictatorship that oppresses the majority, that is very tightly linked to Saudi Arabia, and that, doesn't fit the model of supporting the overthrow of Mubarak in Egypt. And even though I have my own qualms about it, I recognize that we participated in the removal of Gaddafi in Libya. And so I wonder what your view is of the kind of hodgepodge policies we have, and this is especially critical with the now 13-month civil war in Syria.
Well, we're absolutely concerned, and we have a long history of working to push for human rights standards around United States arms sales and military aid, going back to the 1990s and trying to pass an arms trade code of conduct. And we've been very vocal about, the administration's hypocrisy in supporting democratic uprisings some places while continuing to sell arms to governments like Bahrain. Hopefully we'll have some legislation coming out in the House within the next few weeks that will address that and be pushing for those sort of human rights standards across the board, which is especially important right now because the U.N. is starting negotiations on an international arms trade treaty to address some of those issues this summer. And so we want the United States to really be working cooperatively with the international community to support those standards.
Mm-hmm. Now, Rebecca, let's talk about your voter fund and how this works. And feel free to tell people how they can contribute if they would like to support your effort.
Great. And what we're doing now is really looking at competitive races all throughout the western United States, which is where our organization works, and finding people who can win their races, who are positioned to win, and who, again, are with us on these issues, who want to promote a pro-peace agenda in Congress, and not just looking for people who are going to vote the right way, but ideally people that can be partners that we can work with proactively when they get into Congress and building those relationships. And we're also educating the candidates. Most people who run for Congress don't have much foreign policy experience because they've been in state or local government, and it's an opportunity to get the pro-peace message in there very early and get them resources and talking points on how to talk about our issues and address them in a different way. So, with that, we're getting people to contribute through us to candidates in these races, and that's a way for people to, again, make sure that their dollars are speaking for their values. So you're not just giving to a candidate with no indication of why you're supporting that person. When you give through us, you're joining with all these other peace voters and sending a clear message that you're giving to them because you want them to promote this agenda. And as things heat up going into the election, we'll be looking at other ways to support candidates, like putting organizers in the ground in some of the key races, which has been a really successful tactic for us before, so that there's a very visible presence, again, for the peace movement within these elections, showing that, you know, that we're there for people when they need us to win these seats, and then that we want them to be there for us, for the peace voters, when they get into office. And if people want to find out more, you can go to peaceactionwest.org. And our election section is peaceactionwest.org/electpeace. And you can see the list of candidates that we have. You can contribute to them there. You can read more about our work and some of the candidates we've supported in the past and how they've really made an impact on these issues in Congress.
Okay, so I'm looking at a list of some of the candidates that you are supporting. And, Rebecca, the way this works, you basically offer an endorsement, and then individuals who come to your website can choose to donate directly to that individual candidate's campaign. Is that right?
That's right. And, again, they all the money and the information on the donors comes through us, so they know that it's coming through Peace Action West and people who support our agenda. People there can also, if they don't want to choose candidates, can contribute directly to the Peace Action West Voter Fund, and that's the money that we'll use for our efforts on behalf of these candidates.
Okay. And so here in Northern California, you list Norman Solomon, a longtime friend of mine, who is running for Congress in District 2. And just in the interest of full disclosure, I've known Norman for many years, and as it happens, there are 12 people running for this open seat, and I'm working on the campaign of Susan Adams, who is a pro-peace candidate and is a Marin County supervisor who is running in this race. And there's no argument from me that Norman Solomon deserves your support. He has been a strong advocate for these issues, really going back to when he was 14 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And so his credentials are very clear. Also, John Garamendi, who is a guy I've known for 20 years, formerly the Lieutenant Governor of California and our Insurance Commissioner. He is in his first full term in Congress, having taken the place of Ellen Tauscher. And I give John a lot of credit because he's a fairly centrist Democrat in many respects. But the one issue he has been outspoken on, even as a freshman, has been the war in Afghanistan. And I think that, he does deserve the endorsement that you've offered and the support of people who are moving in the direction of peace. And I give him a lot of credit for taking some risk with his, committee assignments and other things that can be used when a Democrat steps out of line.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask you about Janice Hahn. Mm-hmm. She won a special election last year when Jane Harman retired from Congress. And I just want to get a sense of your criteria, because for me in that race, Marcy Winograd was the clear peace candidate.
Mm-hmm.
And she really has some of the same credentials of Norman Solomon, a member of Progressive Democrats of America. Marcy has been outspoken, and she ran twice very strongly against Jane Harman before Harman retired. And then Janice Hahn and Deborah Bowen, the Secretary of State of California, jumped into that race and essentially squeezed her out.
Mm-hmm.
So just tell me what you, and this is not a contentious question.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just curious about how you evaluated those candidates and essentially chose Hahn over Winograd.
Mm-hmm. Well, we were a big supporter of Marcy Winograd when she ran against Jane Harman last time. We're very, very active in her campaign. And we didn't actually make an endorsement there when it was Janice Hahn and Deborah Bowen and Marcy. Mm. So in this case, we're endorsing Janice Hahn in her race against Laura Richardson, who's another incumbent. Because of redistricting, that's how things have played out for 2012. And Janice Hahn, in the short time that she's been in Congress, has been very proactive on these issues. There haven't been very many votes on them since she's been in there, but she's taken advantage of every opportunity to be very active. You know, she gave a press conference on the 10th anniversary of the war in Afghanistan at Arlington West, which is a memorial to fallen soldiers that Veterans for Peace puts up there. She's put out statements for pretty much every media hook. She voted against the National Defense Authorization Bill that funded the war in Afghanistan and included a lot of very troubling provisions for indefinite detention of terrorism suspects. So she has really taken up these issues as a priority and been very vocal on them, and we want to reward that and to encourage her to continue that kind of activity.
Mm-hmm. Also, Mark Takano is a challenger running in what we call the Inland Empire of California, mm-hmm. Riverside, San Bernardino area. And he has impressed me as a real up-and-comer. Mm-hmm. And he's attracted a lot of broad-based progressive support across the state, not just in his own district.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I've been very impressed with him as well. I've had the opportunity to meet with him and talk with him several times about the race and about our issues, and, you know, he's very, very sincere, very engaged, you know, and I think he has a strong progressive foundation. And interestingly, on our issues in particular, you know, he is the descendant of survivors of the bombing of Hiroshima. So that obviously gives him a very different perspective on nuclear weapons policy, which is very critical and a perspective that most people here don't have.
Yeah, and as a tourist, I went to Japan, I visited Hiroshima, and it's staggering to look at the impact of something that happened so long ago and recognize just how serious nuclear exchanges could be. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we must continue every effort to prevent any further use of nuclear weapons. And I hope that that is something that everybody can agree on.
Mm-hmm.
Rebecca, finally, let me ask you about how you deal with the very delicate and complex issues of Israel and Palestine and the overpowering influence that AIPAC and the Israeli lobby has on our Congress. How do you navigate that, and do you have any individuals you are supporting whose primary focus is on justice for the Palestinians?
Well, I think that, you know, this is obviously a big challenge that we face, and it's why the debate on some of these issues that are important to us are so skewed. You know, if you look at the votes on Iran sanctions or some of the other counterproductive moves there on, you know, support, for instance, you know, one of the votes we tracked, you know, was basically a blind support for Israel and its attack on Lebanon.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the debate is very, very skewed. And so I think a lot of this is a long-term issue for us. Again, we know that groups like AIPAC are incredibly active in elections, and they're getting their talking points in there and they're briefing candidates. And that's why it's so important that the peace movement is, again, providing a counterweight and getting in there very early and letting people know there are other perspectives on all of these issues, and that, you know, there are different ways to look at them, and that they, you know, again, we will support them and reward them for taking those positions and really moving the debate. So, you know, pushing back against such a powerful force obviously takes time, but that's why, you know, every election cycle we're getting more involved and building more clout so that we are able to, you know, see a Congress that is more in line with us on those contentious issues, you know, years into the future.
And are there any of the candidates on your list here who are explicitly pro-Palestinian, or and that may be a loaded term, but who want a fair process and who want to see justice for the Palestinian people?
Sure. Well, I mean, I can't say from too many in-depth discussions, but obviously Norman Solomon, I think, has been very active and outspoken on this. You know, somebody like Pete Stark, who we're endorsing, has been a great progressive in Congress for a long time and is one of those people who is not afraid to take those tough votes and be one of the only people in there in those positions. So
that's
there are definitely
true.
People you know, on that list who are taking those kind of positions. And again, you know, we're always trying to find opportunities where there are, you know, positive things that people can do to express, you know, their opinion on those issues. And again, hopefully we're building the relationship with these people now so that when those kind of issues come up, you know, we have an existing relationship and can work with them on those issues.
So to find out more, people can go to your website, peaceactionwest.org, and on the homepage, if you click on the Elect Peace panel, then you'll see these candidates that we've been talking about, and it's real easy to click through and make a contribution if you are able and so inclined. Well, Rebecca, thanks for talking with us today, and I appreciate the work that you're doing.
Great. Thank you so much for having me on.
Rebecca Griffin from Peace Action West. Thanks for joining me for this episode of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peace out.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.